And good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. I'm Doug Rocky, and we're going to take another step in towards education information. From 1917 until 1993, Chanute Air Force Base, Chanute Air Force Technical Training Center, was located in Rantoul, Illinois. Thousands upon thousands of Air Force personnel, Army personnel, Marines, and Navy personnel went through Chanute during the time that was open to get their training. Lots and lots happened. Well, for those of you who are at Chanute, what you'll always remember, if you came in the main gate, the north gate, right off of Century Boulevard, off to the east side of the road, there's always flying a gigantic American flag. And that American flag has been flying over Pat Smith's pawn shop for a long time. Pat, welcome to Warrior Connection.
Well, thanks, Doug. It's good to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you. Well, Pat, I mean, you guys opened a pawn shop in what, about 1975?
That's when I got there, yeah. My uncle had it prior to that. I think he started in 57 or so, and actually had gotten it from a couple of gentlemen who may have started it 4 or 5 years prior.
So the pawn shop has actually been there since the Korean War.
Yeah, I think that's probably exactly when it got rolling.
Wow, that's a long time. Well, I know everybody that's been on Chanute or anything, they've come around, and you've got that gigantic American flag flying above it. It's one of the biggest flags flying in all of East Central Illinois, if not for hundreds of miles around, I think, isn't it?
Well, I'd like to think so, but no, maybe there's a couple bigger. I used to fly a bigger one, but Mother Nature didn't like the size of the pole and decided to take it down. And so we had to go to a smaller flag to keep the pole.
Yeah, could you? Well, anyhow, the pawn shop is located right on the North Base. You've been connected in helping the military personnel for extremely long time. Could you tell her what is a pawn shop? Because for our listeners and everybody in the military, obviously, if they come up short in a payday, we just had this threat on their pay. Sometimes pay doesn't come out, it doesn't work, or they get TDY and they don't get their money. They have a lot of families they have to take care of, and they find themselves short of funds. So a pawn shop has been associated with the military since probably antiquity, hasn't it?
I think that's exactly what got it going. You know, it's as you said, you're in a strange place. There's no family around. I mean, you have the family of the service, but you've got fellows around you in the same boat you are, come up a little short. And so it kind of created the need for that thing to be there. The bank's not going to talk to you, so you take in your watch or that stereo that you just got with extra money you had, and you change it in for a little bit of walking money.
Yeah, so I mean, that's one thing. A lot of people, and those in the military, are familiar with it. You get a lot of airmen, and some of these guys are soldiers. What, E1s, E1s, E2s, E3s, they end up having families. That pay that they receive doesn't go very far, especially if they have a family and they have to move around, does it?
No, not at all. And I think if you have a base that flies people in and out on shorter notice, which this training center did, you'd even have some guys up in the E-78 that all of a sudden at the drop of a hat, they had to be somewhere else in 4 days. Well, if they were between pay periods, they might bring in something of great value. You know, they've acquired some more things as their career has extended, and they might bring in a Rolex watch or a carat diamond ring to have enough money to get them traveled and turn in that chit to get paid when they return.
Yeah, it gets real interesting. I think one of the neat things about Chanute Air Force Base is totally unique in comparison to other military bases. There's never really been a strip. I mean, the Air Force Base was there, and then it directly came into the community. So there wasn't a whole lot of bars. There weren't all these other weird places. I mean, just the standard community. And I guess at one time, where you guys are located, just on the east side, right at the main gate on the east side there of the road, which is 45 or Century Boulevard. But I guess at one time there used to be a hobby shop in that right in front of you?
Exactly, there was. And it had it was there when I got here in 75. But before it, there was a pawn shop. Sold guns and had other the kind of things you'd see in pawn shops, instruments, but kind of leaned heavily on guns, especially antique guns, and lent money, but it was gone by the time I got here, and that hobby shop you referred to it replaced it.
Yeah, the hobby shop, and then, that, you know, and Mark Thompson's now, he's got that slot and wing, it's all the way down in Champaign.
Right.
So, I mean, he's still involved in the business. They just relocated from Rantoul down to Champaign, and then they've relocated to their third location down there in Champaign right now. Well, how does a pawn shop work, and what is the thought behind a pawn shop? I mean, you've explained a little bit, but the guy has, they're short of money for whatever reason, whether they're military or civilian. You don't differentiate there. Just for many, many years, I mean, obviously with your uncle and then you, I mean, you had the military obviously was the main source of people coming in for you.
Absolutely, it was. In fact, I'm sure that this shop would not have been located in Rantoul if it weren't for that base. Generally, you see them, pawn shops, that is, in higher transit areas where universities are at or larger bases. It was actually not as big as what would normally have as many shops. Wouldn't have that strip because the numbers just weren't so great. These were training bases, or this was a training base, so just the population wasn't so big. And like you say, you didn't bring a lot with you, so you just relied on a place like ours to pick up a few bucks to get you through to that next two-week paycheck.
Yeah. So, how does a pawn shop work? I mean, I've known you for, God, I don't know, a long, long time now, and obviously, you know, you've got a whole, I can't even describe it, it's sort of like a totally unique store because you never know what you're going to find in there from day to day.
Yeah, but shops are always different. They're pretty much the character of the guy running it. You'll run into stores that lean kind of heavy on the jewelry. It's small, it's expensive, easy to deal with, doesn't take up a lot of space. They always seem to have some guns, not almost all the time, and usually instruments too, because that's something that's a small package, has some money in it, and something they can use to exchange. So I don't know. Ours, I kind of lean towards the odd and collectible with the base being there. You'd have these guys traveling all over the world, and just the things that they would latch onto and drag around with them for a while, I found just intriguing as could be. So that made it more fun to have the eclectic, odd, not seen in the Midwest stuff. It just was more fun.
Well, it's 20 years since Chanute closed right now, and there's a main stories have been put into our local newspaper, the Rantoul Press and also the News Gazette. And I found it very interesting. I know you and I both talked about this, and we talked about it with your wife, Teresa. It seemed like some of our city fathers had just forgotten the fact that the pawn shop has existed and still exists there.
Yeah, they did. We found that. Well, at first, we were a little, I think we might have got a nose bent a bit, but then it really became a little, it was just kind of funny. One of the fellows made the comment that once the base left, that all of the clothing stores and the pawn shops left Rantoul like rats from a sinking ship. And I thought, now, wait a minute, this rat's still here and have been since the beginning. When I got here, I was the only one left. There was the only pawn shop left when I took over the one I have. And that was in 75. So been here that whole time. I guess he never felt the need to investigate all the corners of his town, so he didn't know we were here. And it's not a very big town, so he must not have got out much.
Yeah, especially with that giant American flag flying above there. Well, I mean, besides being the pawn shop, and I know this firstly from firsthand and working with you, you guys not only have the pawn shop, but you're involved totally in community activities all around here, aren't you?
We are vicariously. We go through other people to do that. Frankly, I'm a little selfish with my time. Not especially proud of it, but just the nature of who I am. But we do like to donate to people who have taken their time to support the community, and we like to support them. So when we can, we do.
That's always good.
Yeah.
Got
to give it back.
How does a pawn shop operate? Say, for example, somebody has something that they need some money. Okay. Could you explain the process of what happens with how a pawn shop operates?
Yeah, I sure can. And it's pretty universal. A lot of the pawn shop's identity and workings has been brought to the forefront through all the programs on TV that we have now. But that's more entertainment than it is reality on some levels. Basically, though, you would have an item, let's say it's worth $100. And by that, meaning if you went out and shopped, you could find one for that number. So most pawn shops would probably lend $25 on that item. And the assumption is financially that it was $100 new. It's not now. If I had to turn it over and sell it, I could probably get 50, maybe a little more depending on the nature of the goods, if I needed to get my money back out of it. So I'm going to go into about half of what I think I could realize if I had to liquidate it on a loan, and then I hold that item. And the person goes out the door with his $25 with an agreement that if he comes back within 30 days, I will let him have it back for a 20% premium over what I lent. And that's pretty much across the board. I think if you went in any state, you'd find something very similar to that.
And you can't. How long do you have to hold an item? Say, for example, somebody pawns a wristwatch, and they get $25 or $50 for the wristwatch from you. How long do you have to hold that item, or how long does a pawn shop have to hold that item before they can sell it if the person doesn't come back?
That's probably the most variable factor when you go state to state. They have different laws. In Illinois at this time, the agreement for the 20% premium is for 30 days. Now, if that person would get to the end of that period and decide, well, you know, I really don't have all of it, but I would pay the interest that you're charging to hold it another 30 days, then, of course, we would do so. But in this state, to protect the consumer, we are held by law to hold it 60 days from the day we sign a contract and never see the fellow again. And the second 30, I think, is just to give him the opportunity to remember that he did it or overcome whatever little hardship he's tied up in, and takes the pressure off him in redeeming his item.
So, okay, so you have that. For an understanding, again, primarily the individuals that are going to use a pawn shop are individuals that need money fairly rapidly. They don't have the ability or they don't have the resources where they can go to a bank. I mean, you know, just when they need $50 or $100, obviously not going to go to a bank and get a loan.
Exactly.
So most of these individuals that go into the pawn shop, historically then of individuals that, again, that's why I was connected with the military, the lower ranks and everybody, they don't have any assets or anything, or they need immediate money that they don't have because they came short up on a payday. So most of these people then are the kind of people that don't have a whole lot of assets to begin with, and they're not real stable in a community where they have a full-time job, or do you see a whole host of people?
No, I actually see the whole host, and that has changed more from these nationally syndicated television programs. The one that comes to mind, of course, that's kind of started the trend was Pawn Stars out in Las Vegas. Well, Rick, the owner, was actually the fellow who put that idea forward to be a program. And he opened the eyes of America to the fact that the shops are run legitimately. There's record keeping. They're reliable. You come back and take care of what you promised to do, and they're going to take care of what they promised to do. Your merchandise is going to be taken care of, and everything's going to fly well. So Rick kind of brought that to the forefront and I think really elevated people's awareness of what a pawn shop was. They had, I think, in the past kind of received some hard times from folks that thought that everything in there was stolen and it was just a bad deal all around. And maybe that existed in the cities years ago, but it certainly hasn't been anything that I've seen in the industry in the 38 years I've been doing it. That's just another business.
Yeah. So when a person comes in with an item they want to pawn, first thing they'll come in and present the item, you get an assessed value of what you think it's worth. Okay, they have to give provide a positive identification of who they are, correct?
Exactly, they do. They have to have photo ID.
Okay, so they've shown the ID, and then you've agreed upon whatever you're willing to give them a loan for whatever duration of time it is. So then they actually sign a contract. Is there written papers that a person signs in agreeing to this loan for this amount of time?
It's sure, yeah, they do. It's basically a bill of sale. They're selling it to me, and the caveat is that I'm agreeing to return it to them in this amount of time that we've come to terms on. So they sign that. There's a description of the item, its model, its serial number. And then we also record a photo ID that they used and their birth date, gender, and such to help identify that someone else has not done it, you know, under the guise of being someone else. And then that's and a copy of that goes to the police station every day so they can check their records if that model and serial number item happened to leave the wrong house a couple of days ago, which is going to happen occasionally. I defy anybody to run any business and occasionally not run into someone else who's doing something illegal. And no matter how careful you are, we're very proud of the fact that it happens very, very seldom, once or twice a year with us.
Well, again, I mean, you run around and hang out and good friends with the police because we all are, and when we go in there, they're there hanging out.
Exactly, and I like that. I like their presence. It kind of lets everybody come in and out of the door knowing, well, if you do have something that doesn't belong to you, this might not be the right place to try to get rid of it.
Yeah, they find out that the police are friends of the owner and, you know, first-name basis where they hang out there, and the same thing with the U.S. mailmen, their first-name basis. It's kind of unique. What, over all the years, I mean, what are the general kinds of amounts of money that you will loan out to an individual? What's the predominant amount of money that a person come in and, you know, say, can I, you know, sell you this and get this in return for a certain amount of time?
Exactly. It changed. Of course, the value of the dollar changed along with it. So I recall back when I started, my uncle telling me that if I could lend out $100 a day, I was going to be doing very, very well. And now I think it would probably be like five times that would be just kind of a getting through your obligations of what it takes to keep the thing afloat. And a good day is, you know, $1,000, $2,000 days. And that would be just on loans.
Mm-hmm.
But in those days, you know, a guy would come in, and $20 was a real common amount of money that someone would want to get. Well, golly, $20, you know, would get you, what, two or three meals at McDonald's. So that isn't cutting it anymore. I think probably a 50 is the new 20, and that would be more common. I would say $50 to $100 loans would kind of the basis of what we write most frequently.
Now, your store is not just a pawn shop. I mean, you have a full set gun shop in there also. You have the pawn shop. All this is all together. You have a regular music shop, don't you?
Yes, we do. It's a complete music store, mostly guitars and amplifiers and combo type stuff. But we do do a lot of band equipment also, you know, like clarinets and saxophones and things that kids will take their first couple of years of music in school. That kind of got generated when Chanute left. I just done I finished a real big remodel and expanded the floor space probably three, four times. And I recall getting done and then hearing that, well, you know, they're probably going to close Chanute. I think, oh my gosh, that's not good. So we kind of diversified, and although we had always had a few guns and always had a few musical instruments, that extra space that I had opened up, I dedicated more to the music and trying to grab traffic from Champaign-Urbana, because there again, it's transient population that drives a store like ours. So you have the university folks coming and going every spring and fall, so that music thing was something that kind of goes along with it, and that helped get that done and keep us afloat. after the base left.
Yeah, so you have, well, we have both Parkland College in Champaign and the University of Illinois, which is obviously, 40,000 students at the University of Illinois. So you got all those people in and out continuously. Now, I think there are also a couple pawn shops on in Champaign.
Yes, there are. And there's been probably as many as 4 or 5 at different times.
Yeah, so again, you've got a whole host of different people. And then again, the area, too, I know with Champaign and Urbana-Champaign County, because of the farming, we've got a very large transient population from migrant farmers that have showed up here in the last few years. Do you see any of those?
Yes, we do. And that community has been really good for our business. They're hardworking people, and when they do something, they do it with the intent of going through with it. And they have kind of filled a niche of some of the other parts of our business that have fallen off over the years. So, like everything else, it's always changing. You just have to modify who you're targeting to get along in it.
Yeah, so it's kind of neat. Well, give us an idea. What are some of the neat things that you've had people bring in or pawned? Could you just talk about a little bit about that? You know, something real unique or strange. It doesn't matter what the value is. I mean, just kind of like you must, in your career in all this year since 1975 and then with your uncle before, you must have seen some pretty neat stuff.
Yeah, you do. And that, to me, is the funnest part. The odder it is, the more interested I am in it. But I've never talked to my uncles, and I've not quit yet, so maybe it's around the corner. It could be tomorrow. But he had one of the fellows out at Chanute come in and he did not take it. I would have tried to pawn a registered lion cub. He had legal paperwork to hold that animal. I have no idea. He must have had it off base. I wouldn't have thought that he could have possibly had it on base. He was probably living out on the economy. But my uncle wouldn't take it. I just laughed at the time. He's more conservative than I, and I would have taken it in a minute. And, you know, as long as I knew it was legitimate. But myself, I kind of like antique arms, particularly Japanese swords and other periods, you know, like World War I and II swords and earlier military rifles and pistols. I think there's a lot of research around that you can delve into to know about it, so it makes it fun.
Yeah, so you have to keep yourself educated and up to speed then on what an item is, what the value is, how much somebody is willing to pay for it on the open market then, don't you?
Well, yeah, you'd like to, and sometimes I think you just have to jump if your instincts tell you that, wow, I'm not up to speed on this, but something tells me it's good. And if you can hit that more often than not, you know, I think you could call it a success, but occasionally, you know, you will error. I've ended up with phony napped points, you know, Indian arrowheads and spear points and such, and thought I had a handle on it. And, you know, you learn a tough lesson now and then. But, you know, it's an education. Those lessons stick longer. So I do know more about that than I used to. It forces you into cracking the books on anything that you weren't successful at and turn that around.
Now, can you say, for example, somebody had pawned something and they didn't come back? Obviously, you know, you wait the 60 days and they don't show up, and therefore you can put it, you know, up for sale in your shop. Do you advertise, or is there some way other people can find out what you have? Do you advertise or sell on the Internet or anything, or do you just strictly work from those people that will give you a phone call or walk in the door?
I have a list of people that I know on more unique items that wouldn't especially have a market here in Rantoul or in the immediate community. And we post quite a few things of that ilk online, mostly on eBay, occasionally a gun broker, and and other arms sites. Do a trade show in arms a few times a year. And word of mouth goes fairly strong. And I do get unique things, so people that like that seem to come around and they let their buddies know. So I think the walk-in's fairly strong.
Okay, well, yeah, I mean, let's talk a little bit about this. I mean, again, you know, you've got a regular gun shop in there, and the laws are changing rapidly, and they've been very strong for a long time. But just for our listeners, again, for the military, they're coming back, they've been on active duty, they're moving around in the community, somebody takes up residence in Illinois. What's required, say, for a military person or a person that's come to Illinois to buy a gun from you? What do they have to do? I mean, they have to get, obviously, go through the whole FOID process for the state of Illinois, correct?
That's correct, and the Illinois State Police handle that. You apply through them for firearm owner's identification, and you're required to have that card if you receive the mail at a residence in this state and have a gun in your possession. You also need it if you want to go hunting in the state with the license for whatever season that you're interested in. You have to have that firearm card to do that also.
Yeah, so and unless a person just can't walk in and say, I want to look at a gun, unless they present positive identification, in this case the firearm owner identification card, but that's not only that, it's also to touch or buy ammunition also, correct?
Correct, yes, you have to have it to buy ammunition also. And we generally won't show a gun to anybody that doesn't have the card. You'll get all kinds of excuses. You know, I left it at home, or I've applied, or, you know, my dog ate it. But it kind of boils down to that if you don't have it to show to me, I can't sell you a gun. And at the point, if I were to hand a gun to show it to someone and he did not have that card, I'm actually breaking the law.
Man, you're not going to do that.
I've given him possession of it, and he can't possess it without the card, so I've entered into something I don't want to be involved in.
So the person comes in, say, they've got to be a resident of Illinois, and they've come here, so they've got to apply for the firearm owner's identification card. I know recently the Illinois State Police have got a backlog, so what used to take 3 or 4 weeks is now up to 3 or 4 months to get a card processed. So once the individual has a FOID card and they come in to purchase a gun, obviously they, you know, you get a positive identification. But again, in your case, I know with us and our friends, after a while you get repeat customers or people that you get to know, and you know them because we're in and out all the time. It's not like they're strangers. So what is the process? Okay, the individual comes in, they're positive identification, they got a FOID card, they hand it, say, I want to look at that rifle or that revolver or the pistol, whatever they're looking at. And then you come in agreement on to what the price is. What are the next steps that have to happen? You have to complete federal paperwork, true?
Yeah, and the funnest part, of course, they hand me money. I like that part. And then you're right, you do a form, and they fill out all the pertinent things that you would on any kind of a informational document, and you record that card number. Then we call that number in to the state police, and they run it and make sure everything's straight on his end of the deal. And they give us an approval number, and we record that on the document that he filled out. And he waits 24 hours, if it's a long gun, before I can deliver it to him, and 72 hours on a handgun.
Yeah, and the whole process was pretty intensive, and you've got a lot of paperwork that you have to do, from positive identification of the person to begin with, where they have to have all the correct documents in their position issued by the state police. And I mean, it's not just a FOID card. You like to use, if you don't know anybody, you're going to, well, show me a driver's license or something else. You get, you know, total double identification of somebody. So once they've got this all done and everything is approved, okay, say, for example, they're buying a long gun, a rifle, or a shotgun. Once you get this all done, it's 24 hours after they signed the paperwork, and then you called it in and got the approval, then they can pick it up. And 72 hours for a handgun, correct?
That's it. Yeah, that's how it works.
And then once they have that, obviously, then, you know, they can pick it up and leave the shop, but obviously they have to secure it in their trunk and, you know, put it in a case or lock case when they leave the store, correct?
Exactly. It has to leave in a closed case. And that case can be a paper sack as long as it's shut. But if the top of the bag is open, then that's not a closed container, and you're still having an issue.
Yeah. So a whole host. And again, yeah. Just you handle you. I mean, obviously, you handle new guns too, because you sell to the police.
Yeah.
I've been right in there when police officers have bought guns from you. So you do special orders, but then also you take care of the antique weapons and everything else, so you can see anything from, you've had everything from current models, Civil War issue stuff in there, and everything in between.
Yes, we have. Even back to Matchlock, it's quite a variety of stuff that can come through from time to time.
One of the big things, and again, the same thing with the pawn shop, when you've got all this thing, one of the big discussions have been happening a lot of times, and it seemed to ease off, was availability of ammunition. Did you run into any problems with that? Or?
Yeah, sure. Sandy Hook changed the landscape considerably. I've been in business long enough that's probably about the fourth time I've seen supplies really go away, and it's that hoarding mentality that we have. We think something's going to slip away from us, so we go out and stack up as much of it as we can. It's not totally without merit, but I think that people do get a little carried away with it and go past their need and just kind of do it knee-jerk and get way more than what is necessary to have and pay too much, and that's the other downside, because they've put a big ripple in the market then. So you run out of 22 ammunition, it's $25, $28 for a 500-pack of 22 ammo. And then during the crisis, there were accounts of people paying $80 to $100 for a 500-round brick, is the expression they use, of 22 ammo. Well, that's not intelligent. And so when the supply starts to come back, you have these folks with all this way overpriced ammunition, it's just like, I'm sorry, buddy, but you just paid too much. That's all there is to it. Got excited and just thought the end was coming. And had the end come, I suppose he would have been brilliant. But it wasn't likely. It's going to come back as soon as the manufacturers catch up.
Which we're seeing happen now.
Oh, exactly. Now, years ago, those fellas would have had warehouses full of stock, and this kind of thing couldn't happen. But now it's manufacturer for delivery on demand. They've timed it, and there isn't any surplus in warehouses. So if the demand is X and they've got it all figured out, well, then boom, then Sandy Hook creates a 3X demand. It all evaporates, and it just takes the manufacturers a long time to catch up with that.
Yeah. On your music shop and your music business, that's kind of the back end of the store. It's all one building, but it's kind of like separated off to the back end. You walk through your pawn shop, and then you're into your music shop. What kind of instruments do you have there, or who comes in to buy instruments? I said you got the whole host of individuals, from students to just your average individual that wants to buy a guitar or a drum or something.
Yeah, exactly. Kids that want to start a garage band, and they need to pick up something more reasonable than what they can walk into a retail store. And, of course, the Internet has changed that quite a lot, where you can order things online and get them delivered right to your door. And those fellows are buying in such a huge quantity that it's challenging to keep up with their pricing. However, those guys don't take trade-ins, and I will take a .22 rifle for a guitar, or a watch for ukulele, or whatever the item might be. And I think that's another thing that a pawn shop is best known for, is trading goods. Because it's kind of a short economy and you don't have a lot of extra money. But hey, I've got Uncle Bob's .22, and although it's pretty cool, I really can't use it. I've got kids in the house. I could turn that into a guitar and entertain my family. It'd be a much more prudent fit. And that's where we fit in.
Well, okay, so you're bringing up here another thing. So a lot of times the individual is selling the item direct outright to you, not for a loan, but for a direct sale, or trading it in and paying additional or whatever, you know, however the money's come out to do for another item.
Yeah, that we do a lot of that, and I encourage it. Frankly, it's good for us because, and I'll tell a customer that, I think I probably wasn't quite as forthcoming when I was 25, but I'm a little past that now, and I realize that you can be pretty straightforward with folks that they're willing to understand the economics. And then again, that show in Las Vegas helped that out. So the customer knows, okay, I'm going to allow him $50 trade-in on his guitar against this $100 thing he wants. And he says, well, you know, but my guitar is worth $75. Well, you're absolutely right, but you're not handing me cash. I still have to sell your guitar.
Yeah, so
but I'm willing to do that for that $25 bump in whatever time it takes. You want to give me the $50 difference for this $100 item you want? I've realized a possible $25 profit, but I still have to sell that guitar, and that's what we do. That's the margins we operate on.
Yeah, so again, it's knowing exactly what's available. So if you have an item, it's like anybody, with a big difference, though. In a real retail store, they don't take trade-ins on new items. I mean, a car dealer does, but even there, sometimes they get limited on what they're going to do. So you'll take that new, that old item in trade on a new item or another item then?
Yes, I like that.
Okay, so say for example, let's go back some, you know, just, and not, we're talking pawn shops in general. Say some, an item is worth $100. Say for example, if an individual is going to pawn that item and wants to get it back after one, they might loan 25% or $25 on that $100 item. Another case it has, say, for example, it's a $100 item, but it's, you know, that was brand new. Now it's used whatever, however old it is. You might come down and realize that, okay, I do have a buyer. I can sell that, where then you'd be willing to give a person $50 for that $100 item with the understanding that you're going to sell it for probably $60 or $75. Is that understand? Is that kind of how it works?
That's a good possibility if the item we're speaking of is marketable. And then that changes the equation quite a lot. And this, say, for instance, it's a guitar. They are marketable. And if he has a name brand that's desirable, then, yes, you can kind of move past that $50 half of new value. Maybe you'd stretch it a little bit, particularly if the guy's trading it in, let's say, on an item that is a really slow mover. It's not that it's not worth $100, but there's not a lot of guys looking for it.
Yeah,
so,
in other words, you might wait a month or 2 months before that one person comes in and says, hey, do you have this?
Well, that's pretty fast around here. It's more like, am I going to send it to kindergarten? You know, I've had it for 5 years. So you get into a situation where, okay, I'm going to give this guy a lot more because what he has I can turn over more easily, even though the numbers aren't any different. But I can sell his easier than mine. I might trade close to even just because it's easier to move.
Are pawn shops, are they more prevalent today or used more today, or is it a thing of the past, or does it come and go with the economy?
That's a good question. I don't have any national numbers on that. If there is one part of my business that I have not kept up to, or maybe even say fell back a little on, is not really keeping a pulse on what everyone else is up to, and have kind of just knocked it out on my own little playground. But from what I see just in the surrounding area, I think they've kind of just barely held their own. The new ones that are coming in now are kind of a more of a corporate thing. They're not quite the owner-operator establishment, I think, that was traditionally pawn shops in the past.
I think there's a brand new one down in Urbana right now that's a corporate pawn shop.
Exactly. I think I've heard rumor that that gentleman or the concern that's backing it has three shops. Well, obviously, if Bob's the owner, he's not 24/7 in three shops, so he's got managers. And they can be just fine, but I think you kind of lose that personal character touch that you get from an owner-operator, a mom-and-pop store.
I mean, you're a mom-and-pop store.
Absolutely. 38 years of it.
Yeah.
And I still like it.
I think one of the neat things about your pawn shop, it's not just a pawn shop or a gun shop or a music shop, but we'll end up, people will come in there and sit on the chairs and stand around and talk.
I'm missing the potbelly stove. I don't have that, but just short of that, it's the general store, without a doubt.
That's kind of the old thing. It's kind of fun because I know there's been a lot of really fine conversations that I've had in your store with all kinds of individuals, whether it's the mailman or the police or, you know, someone with a local businessman or whoever it is. We're just kind of all standing around there having a good time. At the same time, you're doing sales.
Right. Yeah, I have to work that in too. My wife tells me I talk too much. Sometimes we'll be in the middle of details that I should be more specifically attention to, and I'll be yakking about whatever it is that these folks are wanting to yak about.
Yeah. And then
I got to stay on point.
You've got your cat that's always there too, correct?
I'm sorry, my what?
Your cat. Animal, cat, C-A-T.
Oh, cat, excuse me, Doug. I was hearing cap. Yeah, we have three cats, resident bodyguards. Yeah, they're the attack cats. You have to kick them out of the chair you want, or it's their chair. Yeah, they're our mascots, I guess.
That's a lot of fun. Well, I mean, this has been again, ladies and gentlemen, military, we're trying to give you some education, some information, some ideas of how you can, you know, gather a little bit of money. Some days you come up on a shortened payday. We just gone through a whole thing where the government shut down and lots of employees were put on furlough, you know, not knowing when they were going to get their next payday. So those are kind of things when you individuals have that, or a factory has a slowdown. We've had factories here in Rantoul, they've had layoffs for a few weeks or months, haven't they?
Yes, and I think you asked the question, I hope I hit it earlier, that you get quite a wider range of the economic structure coming in and out of stores like ours now than what I would have seen 15, 20 years ago. It's more okay, and unfortunately the need is more here. And so those situations that pop up, we're definitely a short-term lending institution. We're not intending to lend people money and have them paying it back for 6 months. It's more of a two-week or four-week thing.
So
we can accommodate any situation, but that's the norm.
It's an emergency fund.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a quick fallback. It's not a solution.
Yeah, I think you made that very loud and clear. I mean, what's the difference? At pawn shop, obviously, you know, you're taking an item in contrast to a bank or somebody like that or some of the other loan groups where you have to put up collateral in order to get the money, but you're not necessarily giving them an item. And so those are get to be, say, for a bank or, you know, some of these loan things, we're talking about $1,000 or several thousand dollars, aren't we?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And then I had a guy say to me one day, he was kind of chewing on me, so, well, you guys are kind of cold and heartless, you know, you're depending on people's needs. And I said, well, you know, if we were hardened folks, I could see where you're coming from, but we're not. The person did come through the door looking to take care of a small problem, and if he continues to have hard times, you know, perhaps I will end up with his watch, and that would be unfortunate for him. But if I were a bank, I could end up with his house. And so I don't know. Like, it works out pretty well. And it's, if you have a little compassion for whom you're dealing with, and we stretch the rules a lot for folks that we can see really need the help. We're not anywhere near as cold as a bank.
that's the mom and pop, you know, gentle touch that you have. That's important.
Well, we like to think so. I hope that our clientele feel the same way.
Yeah, this seems to be pretty interesting. Well, how can people get in touch with your store? You're called the Pawn Shop. You're in Rantoul, Illinois, and you're just literally right there on Century Boulevard, just off of what used to be Chanute Air Force Base by the North Gate.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right there on what's basically where 45 comes in on the south end of Century Boulevard there. and it's just pawn shop, and then you have a phone number?
We do. Our listed number is 217-893-3280.
Okay, so the pawn shop in Rantoul, Illinois, and the phone number is 217-893-3280. So you got the whole host of products. We're looking at a pawn shop where the historic stand thing, people come in to pawn an item for a certain amount of money, and then that's pawned for 30 or 60 days, whatever the agreement is, and get the return. They pay, say, for example, 20% of what the original loan was. And then if they don't return, say, after 60 days, then you can put that item for sale. And then, again, what you're going to get, be able to get, you have to ask for it to get the money you loaned on it, obviously, and then whatever else is available based on that item. Seems like you got to really be careful in knowing what you're doing all along, don't you?
Yes, you do. There's a lot of fake merchandise out there now, and a lot of people that are making a living presenting that fake merchandise as the genuine article, counterfeit guitars and counterfeit watches and jewelry that's made to look real and marked correctly, but not what it's supposed to be. But, you know, you do it a long time. It's like anything you set your livelihood to, you get better at it as time goes on or you wouldn't survive through it. So 38 years, I make fewer mistakes than I used to. certainly not perfect, though. I love stuff, so I occasionally will jump in a little deep on something that intrigues me. That's where the lessons come from.
Well, you just recently, because I know what's involved in this, you just recently had the opportunity in your lifetime to mark off one of your major bucket list items, didn't you?
I certainly did. And
could you explain that a little to everybody?
I'm jazzed about it to this instant. My dad was a pilot in World War II. He flew B-24s in the South Pacific. And just being around that, I guess, and his stories, I really loved World War II fighters. I just thought they were the nuts. And the P-40, the 38, and the 51 especially. And once a year, Oshkosh is going on, and there'll be a lot of planes headed up that way, and they'll kind of come past Chanute. Sometimes they stop. Mostly they just go over. It's another landmark to follow, run up 57. And the P-51 was it. I decided I just really thought I needed to ride in a P-51. However, it is a little bit expensive, so I didn't have that in my budget. And they came up with the group doing it came up with a really cool idea. They had eight fellas put up individually a portion of what it would take for a single ride and did a raffle on it. And I was fortunate enough. Actually, my wife's name was on the ticket. She's luckier than I am. So I put her name on it, knowing full well that she wasn't going to fly in that airplane. And she said, well, I'm not going to do it. You have to.
This was a red-tailed project with the Confederate Commemorative Air Force, and this was a whole week at the Chanute Air Museum located in Rantoul, Illinois. And, Pat, obviously you were a supporter because I came in to you, asked for your help and support, and you did right away and everything. But they came here, and we had over 1,400 kids that came through the exhibit with the red tails, and I know it was exciting when you got, because we got the pictures, and you got pictures, great pictures that the museum took of you in this flight. But we had a T-6, a P-40, and the P-51 all sitting side by side, offline aircraft. It was pretty exciting, wasn't it?
It was very exciting. One of the more successful events that I've witnessed over the years. I've been out there several times that have a 17 or a 24 come in and for education and to give rides, and participated in some of that. But this event was very, very well attended. And thanks to the big guy upstairs, you know, the weather was absolutely ideal for it. And people came out. It was really a good thing to see.
What was it like when, I mean, you got in the aircraft, they strapped you in the P-51. What was that like? I mean, as he started up the engine and you're rolling out the runway, what was it like? What was going through your mind? What did it feel like?
It was a little bit surreal. You kind of had to pinch yourself. Say, okay, I really am here. This is really happening. The pilot was just a really wonderful fellow. I think his name was Doug.
Yes, it was.
Rosendahl?
Rosendahl, correct.
Rosendahl, yeah. He was a fairly good-sized fellow. He pretty well filled up the front of the cockpit. The seat behind, though, was, I'm not very large, about 170 pounds, so the seat behind him was extremely comfortable. I had really more room than I would have guessed. I would have thought a lot of the pilots that flew those would have been about my size, you know, 5'10", 11, 160, 75 pounds. It was comfortable. Visibility was good. It was a model that where the cockpit glass went back fairly far, so the side view and overhead was really great. And when he took off down that runway, and he said, okay, Pat, this is the fun part, got it up to speed. I felt the rear tail come up, and then I felt the wheels lift, and you have that lightness. And what I didn't witness, of course, being inside, is he had, at that point, he folded up his wheels to pick up a little more speed. And he pulled back pretty hard and banked left, and all the blood ran right out of my head, and I thought, this is amazing. I hope I stay awake for it. I thought I might not be able to take this. But once he had banked out and got up to about 2,500 feet and started to pull out of that, it was just an amazing ride.
Yeah, so ladies and gentlemen, this was what Pat is describing as part of the Rise Above, the Red Tails, again, Tuskegee Airmen. And this is the redtail.org. I know you've got pictures. You are on their website already and on the website for Chanute Air Museum, which is aeromuseum.org. So this is just another thing which absolutely incredible, incredible opportunities. On Sunday, and I know, Pat, if you were out there on Sunday, if you remember, the actual Tuskegee Airmen showed up.
Yes, they did.
Totally fascinating. That made the front page of our paper here, didn't it?
Oh, yeah, of course it would. That was really a wonderful thing.
Yeah, you can meet people that are historical legends, incredible, incredible people.
In past events, there was a 17 out there, and I did not ride on that, but there were some folks standing around, and this older gentleman on the back of a golf cart, and I recognized the fellow driving the golf cart. It was an acquaintance of mine, and walked over to say hello, and it was his dad that was riding along, and he had been a ground crew for the 17s in Europe. And I said, well, are you going to ride today? And he said, you know, Pat, I feel pretty fortunate to be here, and I don't think I'm going to press my luck that far. But he had made it this far, he wasn't going to try it again. I thought that was rather poignant.
Yeah, I know it's not very often that you have an opportunity to check off a major bucket list item.
No, it isn't. And I told my wife she created a monster, though. I'm going to start scraping up the pennies. I'm going to do that again. It was way too much fun to let go once.
Yeah, I mean, there were two raffles, two individuals that won the raffles as part of the Chanute Air Museum project and the Red Tails project. But in addition to that, I think there were two or three other individuals that went up, bought flights with the Red Tails, and went up on their own, didn't they?
They sure did, and hats off to those gentlemen. I'm glad that they have the discretionary income to do that. It really did help the project out tremendously.
Yeah, this whole Red Tail project, I mean, everything they have done for education and the kids, I mean, all 1,400 kids came basically through here for free, going through the museum and to see on this thing, which was a once-in-a-lifetime event, and then you got to go up flying, you and Steve Gray.
Yeah, it was really great. And in the flight, Doug said something to me I thought was very interesting. He said, okay, Pat, you've got a feel of what this air. I'd just flown it for about 5 minutes. Of course, I didn't do anything but just kind of move around a little. And he said, you realize what a tremendous aircraft this is and why people are so excited about it, because it's just intuitively responsive to the pilot. He said, okay, now think about this. You're, you know, barely 20, 21 years old. You just came up out of the South. You're a black male in the United States, and you're in the front seat of this aircraft flying your mission wherever. Can you imagine what was going through that young man's mind?
These Southern Airmen went on to greatness in everything they did, didn't they?
Oh, everything, yeah. But you'd have to feel absolutely next to God at that point. It would just have been an exhilarating experience to have come so far.
Well, you know, at the end of the poem again, and I reached out and touched the face of God.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Pat, thank you for coming on Warrior Connection. Ladies and gentlemen, education, when you get short on your budget, here's a pawn shop. It's an opportunity. Pat, thank you very much. Anybody needs help or has questions, obviously they can call your pawn shop, the pawn shop in Rantoul, Illinois. And the phone number again is area code 217-893-3280. Well, Pat, thank you for everything you've done for the military and supporting the families over, God, what, many, many years. Snoot was there, what, 75 to 93? It's almost 20 years where you were directly supporting them.
It's been a pleasure, and I appreciate you having me on, Doug, and sharing everything with all the folks out there.
Well, thank you, Pat. And, Therese, tell your wife thank you for giving us your time.
You bet.
See you later, Pat. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and have a good evening.